a special level.
Okay, we'll begin.
This session is called Eritrea, the Forbidden Land, Freedom and Justice for All. My name is Maria Haman Zuniga, and I live in Nicaragua. I'm a health educator. And today I'm going to not be quite as participative as we were the other day. I'm sorry, but this is a different plea. First of all, I'd like to ask if anybody knows where Eritrea is, or if you've ever heard of Eritrea or know somebody from there. Yes?
Well, I know where it is. But
where is it?
Well, isn't it some province in Ethiopia, or in the present-day Ethiopia, but I'm not sure where.
Uh-huh. That's pretty good. Anybody else?
I just know the place, but I had no idea at all.
No? Then you won't know why it's called the Forbidden Land. Well, that's quite significant that nobody knows where it is, because that's just what the world wanted. One time, and we're going to look a little bit at the history of this country. Why don't you just all come over here? We're way over here in the state of Washington. Can you find where we are? Can you read the map?
Where is it again?
No, where are we right now? Well, that's pretty good. Your finger's covering
it. I'm trying to find where we are.
Yeah, we're up there. Eastern
Washington.
And I live down here, right here, in a place called Managua, in Nicaragua. But over here, on the other side of Africa, there is a country that's called Ethiopia. And Ethiopia did have a northern province that was called Eritrea. We'll go into the history a bit. You don't see Eritrea here, but it's all of this land that is on the Red Sea. And one of the reasons that we in the United States don't know a lot about Eritrea is precisely because it is something that our State Department has kept quiet since the 50s. And I'll explain that. But here's the Red Sea, the Suez Canal up there, and the Gulf of Aden, and over here Saudi Arabia and Iran. And over here's where we had the war last year. So we'll come back to the map a little bit later.
Does Sudan then have this instead?
Sudan?
Yes, but is that their land?
That's their land.
Instead of Ethiopia's?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Sudan is Sudan.
And
this is Somalia, where we're hearing about a lot of famine, and we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about why there's famine in these countries.
Did Ethiopia one time have this?
They had this.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
This.
And that's where it is.
Eritrea is this little piece of land. It goes like this.
Oh.
But it's all the coast.
Who owns it now?
Well, that's what we're going to talk about.
Just who has it?
That's what we're going to talk about. Okay. Now, some of you do know about Ethiopia, don't you? What can you tell me about Ethiopia?
That's the desert.
It's a desert?
Large section of the border is on the ocean.
But historically or biblically, what do we know about Ethiopia?
Strong Jewish tradition there, and a lot of them were out transported recently to Israel.
No, I want to go way back.
Berbers?
I want to go way back.
To the Great Rift Valley?
Well, the Rift Valley comes through there. Yeah. No, the story is that King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba formed a dynasty, which is called the Lion of Judah. The Lion of Judah was Ethiopia. And so it's heard of in biblical times. It's talked about in the Old Testament. You know, the country that we now call Ethiopia, that territory, because remember in those times, well, there weren't the same countries that there are today. Ethiopia was invaded in the late 1800s, in about 1889. The Italians began their colonization of Africa, just as you know, the European countries sort of divided their colonizations around the world, you know, and they formed their empires. Well, the Italians moved in to northern Africa, and they colonized countries like Libya, what today is Libya, what today is Somalia, and also Ethiopia, the country of Ethiopia, and this northern part of Ethiopia that was known even in those early times as Eritrea. Now, the Eritrean province for the Italians is very important. They set up their two major cities in the Eritrean lands. And one of them was Asmara, a high place. You've been in Antigua, haven't you? Did you tell me you'd been in Antigua?
No,
that was somebody else. That must have been John. Well, Antigua and Guatemala is very, very similar to Asmara. It's high land, 8,000 feet, more or less. Very pleasant climate, very beautiful. And it still is like the Italian city that was built there in the late 1800s. Farther inland, well, Asmara's in the highlands, but farther in the highlands of Eritrea, there's a place called where they had, just a minute, just a minute, because I'm thinking of Asmara. Well, they established a city which was an industrial city, and they colonized in order to grow grapes, to make wine. They colonized also to grow coffee in the highlands. They grew some cotton, and in the industrial town, they set up all of the factories that were related to the kinds of production that they were carrying out. So they would grow the grapes, and then they would make the wine, and they would ship it on the railroads that they built off to the Red Sea and on to Europe. And in the early 1900s, this part of the country of Ethiopia became a very industrialized area. One out of every five people in that part of Ethiopia were living in cities. So, but many people were working in these factories and on these plantations. When the Second World War took place, Mussolini moved even farther inland, but the British defeated the Italians in Eritrea, in Ethiopia, and they took over the country, and particularly this part. Now, why this part of Ethiopia, in quotation marks, is so important is because it is the door to the sea and to commerce. No. But farther inland in Ethiopia, there are many tribes. There are still many tribes. And they speak a different language. They speak Amharic, which is the language of the Ethiopians. And then there are people on the borders of Somalia and further down toward Kenya that also speak different languages. There are many tribal groups. But this particular area of the country that wasn't highly industrialized by the Italians became important to Europeans. And at the end of the war, there were about 60,000 Italians living in this part of Ethiopia that is now called Eritrea. One thing that the Italians didn't do was allow the Eritreans, and there are nine different ethnic groups among the Eritreans, they did not allow them to become involved in trade unions or in political parties or anything like that. There was a color bar. There were the Italians and there were those others, colored. Now, because there are many different tribal groups, it's not easy to classify them as one people, but that's what the Italians did. They considered them to be those,
and they didn't allow them to develop their educational systems or anything. Well, when the British won out over the Italians in 1941, there was a military administration that was put into effect, and that ruled that part of, well, ruled Ethiopia really until about 1952. Now, in 1952, the Foreign Office took over, the British Foreign Office, and they set up literacy programs, they set up schools for children, health programs, and they developed, they let the Eritreans develop political parties and trade unions. Now remember that there had been a highly industrialized situation. But one of the things that they did after the war, you know, the war machine was kept going during the war. The British used those factories and used the light industry there for their war machine. But when the war ended, there was suddenly a slump. Now, the really important time for Eritrea is when the war ends. Because in the 50s, in 1950, when they were going to decide what was going to happen to these countries of Africa that had been colonies, the UN met and they formed a commission. And in the case of Libya, and all of you, I think, know something about Libya, at least you know who the leader of Libya is. Libya was given its independence. Somalia was given its independence. But there was great discussion about what was to happen to Eritrea. Because the powers that be felt that, let me find it again, felt that they just couldn't let this little tiny country be formed. Although there was a sense of national identity and so on the part of the people who were living there, they felt that this couldn't come about. And so the United Nations decided that this province would be federated to Ethiopia. It would not be an independent country. It would be federated. And I want to read you something. John Foster Dulles, this wonderful man, who was the Secretary of State, said in 1952, "From the point of view of justice and the opinions of the Eritrean people, the opinion of the Eritrean people must receive consideration. Nevertheless, the strategic interest of the United States in the Red Sea Basin and considerations of security and world peace make it necessary that the country has to be linked with our ally, Ethiopia." Now, what's so interesting to me is the whole business of Eritrea, for me, is just another reinforcement of the same kind of imperialism that was going on nearly at the same time in Central America. And I'm just going to do a parenthesis here. You're probably wondering why I'm even talking about Eritrea. So I want to give you a little bit of that background. You've heard this before. Well, about 17 years ago, a group of us in Central America began meeting together, and we formed a network of community-based health programs, groups that are working in the different countries of Central America and Mexico, working with community health workers, volunteer workers, usually people from villages or from urban neighborhoods, but at the first, basically in rural areas, and training these people who may have only 2 or 3 years of formal education, training them to be the health agent in their communities. And this has really been quite successful, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about it tomorrow, about what we have done in Central America. But the important thing is that this idea that began in the mid-60s of community-based health workers has really been, for many people in rural areas and in marginal areas of Central America, the only health service available to people. Now, some of us who have been working together for a long, long time in these different countries also have connections with people in other countries. And about 8 years ago, several of us began to talk about trying to have what we call in the South, South-South dialogue, and bring people together who are working in different places in the world and learn from one another, learn from our experiences, learn from people in the Philippines or from people in India, Bangladesh, South Africa, and so on. And so over the years, we talked about the idea of having a meeting of people in societies in transition. And when we were talking about societies in transition 8 years ago or 6 years ago, we were really talking about nations or groups in liberation struggles, national liberation struggles, a transition from an oppressive situation, from dictatorships, leading to, at that time, our hope was leading to a socialist state. And then the Berlin Wall fell. And the world changed for many, many people, and it changed for us too. Because not that we were hoping for Eastern European socialism, because we weren't. The liberation struggles are nationalist struggles, and they're struggles for justice and for equality, and for freedom from military dictatorships. In any case, the world changed because the forces that be changed. And we still felt that we were societies in transition, but in a different kind of transition. And this came even closer to home to us when in 1990 the Sandinista government lost the elections. And so we were also in transition in Nicaragua. Well, in any case, with the Sandinista defeat, some of us decided we must have this meeting and we must have it now. And so last year in Nicaragua, we met. There were 12 of us, people from very progressive, very radical thinkers in healthcare from different nations of the world, from Latin America, from Africa, and from Asia. And one of the groups that was invited to participate with us was the group of the Eritrean Public Health Association because of their progressive work, which I will explain in a moment. But because on the 1st of May, on the 26th of May of 1991, their 30-year war ended. They could not come and be with us in Managua. I had met with the director of that public health program early on, at the beginning of 1990, I think was the first time that I met him, and had asked him to participate, but he couldn't come to that meeting. And so, just after Easter of this year, I received a phone call from one part of the coalition of non-governmental agencies, European, Canadian, and U.S. agencies that have been supportive of Eritrea over the years. And the group in the United States that has been particularly active is called the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. I don't know if any of you are familiar with them. It is sort of like the Quakers, the Friends Service Committee, but it's the Unitarian Church. And they called me to say that in 1 week they wanted me to go to Eritrea to be part of a consultation with the government of Eritrea, the provisional government of Eritrea, with non-governmental Eritrean organizations, and with the international organizations that form the coalition that's been helping with Eritrean relief for about 10 or 15 years. So I went. I didn't know much about Eritrea either, to be very honest with you. Until I met the people in the public health program, I really didn't know about Eritrea, and it has a lot to do with what John Foster Dulles said. You know, they would say those things publicly in the Congress, in order to get money or in order to make decisions. But there was never very much publicity given to the Eritrean situation. Very few of us knew, for example, that from the early 50s on, there were 3,800 U.S. servicemen in Asmara, in the largest listening post that the U.S. had in the entire world, and that was in Eritrea. As I said, Asmara is very high, very, very well located to control all the radio communications that are going on all around that particular area of the world. And since it's always been a trouble spot, ever since the time the time that the Jews began, the Jewish people began, and we've been reading Jeremiah this week, and I think a lot about that. You know, it's very close by, really, to our origins, our Judaic origins as Christians. Well, in any case, I decided that I would accept the invitation. And that's why I went to Eritrea. And that's why, after the experience of being there and understanding more about the struggle, I have decided that I want to share with many people what I learned about this amazing people. Well, in any case, I stated what happened. The U.S. government voted against Eritrea becoming an independent country, and so it became federated with Ethiopia. And Ethiopia, of course, was at that time in the power of a man, an emperor called Haile Selassie. And Haile Selassie traced his origins to the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. He was the direct descendant, and he acted like it. His palace was just incredible. He had several of them, but he had one in Asmara, and it's still there today, and people can go in. And he even had a special room in his palace for the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, when she came to visit him. And very closely allied with the U.S. government and with the British government. Now, what happened was, when Haile Selassie came in, he replaced the language of the people of these different tribal groups with the Amharic language. And there were some massacres as people rebelled against this. And at one time, in 1961, in a secret memorandum to the U.S. State Department, the council in Asmara wrote, "The unification," in quotation marks, "was prepared and perpetrated from above in maximum security without the slightest public debate or discussion. The vote by acclamation was a shoddy comedy barely disguising the absence of support, even on the part of the government-picked Eritrean Assembly." So, from the very beginning, the idea of the federation. In foreign policy, in international forums, and within the country of Ethiopia, was all set up so that these people could not have their freedom and their national integrity. In 1974, Haile Selassie fell, his government fell, to a group of military men in the Ethiopian army. And these military men at first wanted to have the support of the United States, but since the United States had been so supportive of Haile Selassie, they couldn't just overnight say, they will now support this new government. And so this new government sought the support of the Soviet Union. You know? And the Soviet Union was more than happy to get their foot in there, in the same place, because, of course, remember what was going on in those years. So you have the superpowers there making decisions about what's going to happen to all of this part of the world. These are little tiny countries. They don't have a lot of people in them. They're tribal kinds of groups, different ethnic groups, different languages. Many times they don't have unification. And so it's very easy to manipulate and even pay off these people. So what happened is that war began. Now I'm going to go into this a little because it really affects what happened. Remember that in the time of the Italians, we had beautiful vineyards and we had plantations from the highlands down to the lowlands with cotton in it, and we had this whole industry going on. Well, the British moved that out. They sold off the factories, they sold off the cement, they tore up the railroad lines, and they eventually left. So what Haile Selassie had been trying to maintain for himself, a lot had been lost from what had been there at the time of the Italian colonization. And there were groups. In 1961, a group formed, a liberation front, that sought to win their freedom from the Ethiopian, from Haile Selassie. And that went on for a number of years. When Haile Selassie's government fell, and Mengistu government came in, and had the support of the Russian, of the Soviet Union, what happened was a very interesting thing. Instead of trying to bring about some sort of reconciliation with the people of Eritrea, the war went on. And the Soviet Union began to pour in money and arms and equipment and so on. And the government of the Soviet Union spent, in the late years of the war, in the 80s, approximately $1 million a day fighting the war between Eritrea and the Ethiopians. Now, we did the exact same thing here. That's how much money the U.S. government put into Salvador. Mm-hmm. And it's the same sort of thing. A group of people fighting for self-determination and for their autonomy, and superpowers just pouring the money in. Now, a lot of people heard about the Horn of Africa in the mid-80s. Some of you probably watched on television a program where rock stars came out singing for the Africans dying of starvation in Somalia, Ethiopia. Remember those pictures of the starving Ethiopian children? Now, what a contrast where you have children dying of starvation, I mean real starvation, while a government is spending over $1 million a day fighting a war against other people of similar origins. No. Well, one of the reasons that we didn't know about the struggle of the Eritreans is that people didn't talk about that war that was going on. But the war went on for over 30 years. No. It ended exactly 30 years after it began. And it ended with the Eritrean Liberation Front being the winners. Now, that took a while. That particular period that I was talking about is really important, because what we saw in Eritrea in the development of the Liberation Front was that tribes people, the 9 ethnic groups of Eritrea, were brought together with a common goal, and that goal was their national liberation. And one of the things that the EPLF did was not divide people on their racial or their ethnic background, but they said, we are all Eritreans. And I was speaking to, what's your name?
Noah.
About an Eritreans that they have in their church. And the Eritreans always say that they're Eritreans, they don't say they're Ethiopians. But they also always say they're Eritreans and don't say that they belong to an ethnic group. Because one of the things that their liberation movement tried to do was not destroy their ethnicity, but to have them realize that even though they were this kind of tribesmen or spoke Tigri or spoke Tigrinya, they were first and foremost Eritreans. And everywhere I went in Eritrea, I would see people that I obviously could identify as having different tribal origins, But no, say, where are you from? And they would say, I'm from Eritrea, I'm an Eritrean. And nobody would say that there were anything else. And that comes out of their long years of struggle and their identity of being fighters, those who were fighters. And at the end of the war in 91, there were 50,000 fighters. One third of them were women. And this is very significant because we're talking about cultures that are very traditional cultures where women were downtrodden. Women were kept in their homes. Women were not allowed to participate in politics and so on. And so the fact that the Liberation Front worked also to liberate women is important to us who believe in that. And what happened is that so many people went away and joined the fighters and looked for ways that they could be the retaguardia. What is a retaguardia? The rear guard of the Liberation Front. And so as time went on, and even in those years of the mid-80s, the Liberation Front controlled large parts of the country. But in the movies that we'd seen, and it's really unfortunate that I didn't bring one of these movies with, but it's about that war, and it's about the starvation that was going on and the publicity that was being given to starvation, and at the same time, bombs were falling. And the people of Eritrea never worked outside or were visible in the daytime because those MiGs would come over and they would be bombing in the daytime in the areas where they had their agrarian reform, where they were growing things, where they had their hospitals and their health work. And I'll explain a little bit about that. And so all day long, every day, the bombers would come. And any place there was something green, any place there was the sight of water or the movement of people, those places would be bombed. Now, I'm not just saying that. That's why I wish I had the footage. Because it's really incredible to see what these people did in the face of this tremendous military machine that worked against them. They built a wall that's 400 kilometers long, and that was their front. And I mean, it's just, you can walk or run from one end to the other. It's that long. And that, from there is where they fought and would try to gain more territory. And they controlled a large amount of territory at the time of the famine in the mid-80s. And what they had to do was try to find ways that food could reach the people who were caught in that forbidden land where nobody could be, because the tribespeople were out there. And they would look for ways to move the food out at night under the cover of the night to get the food to the people. But the food was sent to Port Sudan. And it was sent by different countries of the world. It was sent because of the calls for the famine. But the question was never asked, and the question was never brought up in the rock concerts and in the discussions around the world about why is there starvation in Ethiopia? Mm-hmm. There was starvation in Ethiopia. There was starvation in Eritrea because everything they planted was being destroyed. Mm-hmm. No? The land was becoming desertified. Deserts were being formed on this land because war had been going on for 25 years. And war meant destruction of villages, it meant destruction of crops and industry and light industry. It meant destruction of everything because it was destruction and massacre that the Ethiopians were doing. But on the Ethiopian side, they were also starving. They were starving because their government was not putting the money into development or into food production. It was using the money to maintain that 30,000-man army that the Ethiopians had. And you can be sure that the army that the Ethiopians had was an army that came from the poorest people, the tribes people, of the southern part, mostly, of Ethiopia. So the time is getting away from me.
Could I just ask briefly, but who is funding who? I mean, like, who? It was the Soviets who were funding Ethiopia?
Yes.
And then who was funding Eritrea?
Practically nobody. The Eritreans never had the support of any major power of the world, because all of the powers of the world were interested that that particular land not belong to any of the superpowers. And so nobody was helping them have their national independence. And so what they developed, because they had worked in factories and there was this light industry, these people set up cities and factories underneath the ground in the desert. And that's how I first knew about them. I heard about the work being done on the training of these community workers. They trained barefoot doctors. Well, they really weren't barefoot because they used plastic sandals. They used plastic sandals made of PCB that was also produced in their factories underground. And they had these whole villages out there in the desert and underground. And if you see the pictures, you see hospitals, you see operating rooms, you see workshops for physical therapy, you see manufacture of medicines and sueros, IV fluids, and whatever. They could do almost anything. And one of the reasons they could do it is because there were about 30,000 Eritreans that left through the camps and eventually were able to get to other countries. Eritreans that had education, had some possibility of getting out as refugees, but having countries accept them. So there are Eritreans in the United States, in Canada, in Holland, in England. And wherever those Eritreans went, they advanced their education, and they began to send to their people support for their struggle for liberation. And some of them are very, very highly qualified. There's an Eritrean as one of the heads of the World Bank. There are Eritreans that are working on satellite identification of water sources. Imagine what that person can do now to be of help to the government. There are all sorts of other questions that do come up, because there are people who say that it won't be easy to go back to Eritrea, and so there have to be plans. So how people from their newfound life, I mean, you know, people are living comfortably in Washington State or Calgary in Canada or wherever, it's not going to be easy for them to transplant their families to Eritrea to a very difficult situation. But their skills can be used, and they have this tremendous dedication to want to use their skills. There's so much solidarity. I've never seen anything like it. And so when finally the Ethiopian army fell, it fell because of what was happening in the world. The socialist bloc fell. You know, there was not going to be any more support for that Ethiopian army. The Ethiopian army turned around defeated. You know, they met up against this army that actually would take broken down tanks and trucks and anything that they captured. And when you go out with them to the countryside, they'll say, well, you know, that was an Ethiopian tank, but it was ours. We captured it and then we used it. And that's how they won their war, because they had the spirit and the Ethiopians didn't. The Ethiopians were these conscripts that were sent out there to fight a war that they didn't really know a lot about. So today there is a provisional government. Now, why is there a provisional government? Well, the EPLF said, we want to go back to those agreements that were made in the 50s with the United Nations. And we want our people to vote to decide if they want to be part of Ethiopia or if they want to be an independent country. So they're using international law as the basis for their decision to, at this time, be a provisional government. And in May of 1993, they will have a referendum, and the people of the country will decide whether they will be Ethiopians or whether they will be Eritreans. Well, I'll tell you, there's no question in my mind that they will be Eritreans. But they will be Eritreans knowing exactly what that means. A little country, 4 million people, very severe war damage, absolute total destruction of the port, because before the Ethiopians left, They bombed everything. There's nothing left there. They were receiving goods on open docks because everything had been destroyed. They destroyed hospitals. This is against the international agreements for the conduct of war, which nobody really followed, but this there. No, the same thing happened in Nicaragua, the same thing happened in Salvador. But there they went in and into a 400-bed hospital that had been built with help from the Norwegians, and they just destroyed everything with their machine guns and their grenades. And now the Norwegian Red Cross is going to rebuild that hospital. You know? And some organizations, but very few, are continuing to help. And that's the meeting I was at, was to talk about what could be done. But the interesting thing about the Eritreans, and I think it's a lesson for all of us, they're tremendously self-reliant. During all those years, those 30 years of war, when nobody would recognize their struggle, and nobody would really give them real help, considerable help. It's not like the counter-revolution being helped by the United States, no? Or Cuba being helped by the Soviet Union. It's a really very different situation. They had built up their whole society around the idea of land reform, around the idea of women having rights and responsibilities, around the idea of education in the different languages of their ethnic groups, having an official language, but also teaching people to read and write in their own language. They did those literacy classes, their health programs, and so on. And so they're tremendously self-reliant people, and that's what they say. We are going to make this go, and even if all the countries of the world don't want to give us help, we're going to do it with what we have, which more than anything is the self-determination that they have. So it really was a beautiful experience. But now I've talked a lot, and maybe you do have questions, and maybe I can answer them. This has been very quick. But if you do have an opportunity to learn more, there's really a connection, and that's what I want to make. There's a connection between famine and conflict. And we can't talk about famine as being the fate of African people. Mm-hmm. There's famine because of conflict, and those conflicts are related to what world powers are fighting about, and they don't care about the people, especially if they're black.
I'm not real knowledgeable about this, but there's a talk now of another famine. I think it's already being in the paper that will come in like a year. That will be a terrible famine. Is there a connection then?
Well, actually, there is a famine right now, and it's in Somalia. People are dying on the roads every day. I try to listen every day to find out what's happening. But again, it's not being talked about what was happening in Somalia. No. And there's a war going on between Somalia and Ethiopia. And it's all about where they are. You know, these countries that are on the Red Sea and the importance of that. And the fact that nobody goes in there and really tries to stop the conflicts or mediate the conflicts or let the conflicts be mediated. It's sort of like, well, you know, if people keep fighting each other, they'll just gradually remove themselves from the situation and somebody will come in there. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, I feel like that's the way it is. Nobody cares if hundreds of people... There was this Australian journalist who went to Somalia just in the last couple of weeks since I've been here. And he was saying that just in about 15 miles, he counted hundreds of people dead on the road trying to get to the city to get some food. And these were women and older people and little children. And the same kinds of terrible pictures that we saw of the famine in the mid-80s in Ethiopia.
So it's more the result of politics than it is of weather.
That's what I want to say. And why has the weather changed? Why did when I went to some places on the highlands and I ran into this man from Calgary, incredible, but he was an Eritrean who was traffic controller in Calgary. And he said, I left here 18 years ago. And this was a forest. This was a forest. All this that you see around you is highland, it's beautiful. But there was one water source. And the next water source was about 5 to 6 miles away. And people were coming in with their camels and loading up with this one well. And he said this was a rich forest land. And so there was deforestation and there was conflict. There was bombing and destruction. And that's what's happening in many of those countries. Not all, but that's part of it. And you start that process and it gets out of hand. And so what the Eritreans are saying is they want money for development. They don't want handouts. They want money for simple development projects on their agrarian reform projects so that they can start growing crops again, identify where there's water and work around those areas where there's water. And I think that it's so easy for us to just see these images that come to us on the television set of poor people dying of starvation and not ask what are the real causes. And that's what the Canadians did. The Canadians in the mid-80s did a program, Oxfam of Canada and, well basically Oxfam of Canada presented a program on Canadian television about the politics of famine. And they talked and they showed films of the Eritrean liberation movement, and then they discussed, they debated what was happening. And the Canadians made a decision to give support to development as well as famine support. But most of the time we don't look at the real reasons. I think that if you go and look back at lots of famines in history, they're related to conflict.
I saw a long program on TV about a year ago that showed the effect of worldwide weather because of what we pump into the environment,
mm-hmm.
and how we are, because we are so affluent, what we pump into the environment, how it affects the weather
mm-hmm.
changes in other parts of the world
mm-hmm.
and how we are responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions?
I'm just really amazed, though, that the media coverage, from what I understand about this whole concept that there even was a place called Eritrea, is totally lacking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not even probably in the New York Times.
No. In the United States, practically nothing has been published. Whereas in Britain, for example, because the British had a stake there, and the labor parties and the socialist parties of Europe really have been supportive of the liberation movement politically, not so much in terms of money, but politically they've been supportive of them. And so in Europe, and especially in Britain, I've seen much more knowledge and understanding of what was happening in Eritrea. And I know British doctors who went to the front and worked in the hospitals and help to train these barefoot doctors, which is another whole beautiful story. Really, really interesting. Very highly qualified. And now some of those people are back in their villages, and of course they are the health service at this point in time in those villages. You know. And the women's movement continues to be very important. This is just an interesting thing that sometimes we don't think about. One of the little factories that they had out there in the middle of the desert was a factory to make toallas sanitarias, like Kotex, sanitary napkins, thank you. This is my daughter, for those who don't know. Sanitary napkins. And you see, before they had those, the women who were like nomadic women would stay in a tent while they had their period, and they would bleed into the sand. And they would prepare the meals, but pass them out of the tent, you know. And see, it completely immobilized women. So imagine what it means to have a sanitary napkin and to be able to move about. And that's part of women's liberation, you know. And it's just such a simple thing, brought about a cultural change. The other thing is, there's a lot of infibulation, you know, where they cut the clitoris of the women, or they cut the labio and sew it up. And the Liberation Front made a decision that they would teach people about this and that this was dangerous for the health of women. and also not very pleasurable. And so their feeling is that this has to stop, but they can't, like the new government's not going to declare a law that makes it illegal because you have to educate people. So the whole idea of bringing about change is going to be through education and through building awareness. And some people still believe that they should follow their old ways. They are about one half Christian, Coptic Orthodox Christians, and about one half Muslim. And so they have some real feelings on these issues, but the women who are in the women's organization are very adamant that they have to go slowly and work with women to help to change attitudes. You were in the session this morning, so were you, weren't you? This morning's session where we talked about attitudes about Well, this morning we had a session and we discussed attitudes towards sexuality. And, you know, it's very hard to bring about changes in this. And so a law isn't going to be declared to make women free. It's going to have to come about with the women who have been fighters, and I said 30% of them were. By fighters, I mean people who were in the front, although they weren't all gun-toters, if you will. But it's very exciting, and what some of us hope to do is really to let more people know what's going on. And to go back to what I was saying at the very beginning, the idea of having a dialogue between people who are progressive health workers, one of the ideas that we have is to share our experiences across the world. And we really are an organization or a network of people who are interested in analyzing and influencing the politics of health. And part of that politics of health is really the recognition of the importance of community-based health workers, and the importance of grassroots work and participation in health, and equity and responsibility. And some of us feel that the Eritrean experience is really an experience that should be shared across the world. And sometimes that means translating things, materials and experiences into other languages, not just English, not just Spanish, but even languages of the groups of people that we're working with in South Africa or in Zimbabwe or, you know, wherever, Philippines. And so it was really this network that we wanted to build that brought me to a close relationship with the people of Eritrea and my interest in sharing with others. And also just making the connections about what happened in Central America that a lot more people know about is exactly the same kind of thing that happened there in Africa and that's happening in the Philippines and other places. You know, this kind of thing is repeated over and over. It's not a single foreign policy. It's a massive foreign policy that is imperialistic.
Mm-hmm. Are there plans for that network to continue to share those ideas?
Yes, we're just beginning. We will have our second meeting now in November, and it will be on the West Bank with the Palestinian Union of Medical Relief Committees. So that's going to be our second meeting. And we're going to try to go out from there.
What did you study to do this kind of work? I have a daughter that's sort of interested. I'm curious to know if she...
Well, I don't know if what I studied is what got me here, but I'm a health educator. I studied...
You have a degree in public health?
I have a degree in public health mm-hmm. from the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of it has to do with you know, my own interests. And then working in a third world country and the whole exposure to what's going on and seeing what we do in this country and from my experience of being there and actually having to be a victim of what the U.S. decides. Because I said to somebody last week, you know, if I had come here 3 years ago, the work that I did and continue to do and me and my family would have been considered enemies of the United States government, not the United States people. But a lot of people would have felt that way, you know. Maybe they still do. But in any case, you know, what made me what I am is the series of experiences that I've had over the years. But it's very interesting work. So, any other questions? I think we went over time, but thank you for your...
Thank you.
Tomorrow I'm at night. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about health and the Latin American identity. But really, I'll get into some of these issues about community health workers.
You know, there's a Circumpolar Health Conference that they have every 4 years that has loads of money behind it.
The what conference?
Circumpolar Health. So they get Norway, Sweden, Finland. Folks from Russia come to there, Iceland, Greenland, Alaska. That's how I got in, like Canada. And they have some similar things that they share, but generally, of course, the stuff I pay attention has to do with the local folks.
Well, you know, if you give me your address, I can put you on my mailing list of people that might be interested in knowing more. And we want to make connections, but the thing is, we have a very particular point of view. You know, we are against medical establishment. I can let you read one of our statements. Maybe they'll let me give you a photocopy upstairs. When do you go?
I go tomorrow.
Okay, I'll see if I can photocopy it upstairs. I'll give you a copy.
Yeah, I have
a card. Actually... Sorry, where are the tables?
They're on your dresser. Sí, los puse ahí.
Dresser. Donde ve la ropa.
Sí.
Arriba.
No. Donde tiene su reloj, sus cositas así.
Pero no los
encontré. So you will put me. Alright, let's eat supper first and then we'll go. We have Vespers tonight too. This is a bit.
Oh, you're going to do Vespers.
Yeah.
Could you write your address down? The reason I really think that even though I realize you're dealing with a lot more health education and stuff like that, I think that you'd find the book that I worked on valuable for, you know, for folks who are interested in. I mean, some of these folks have to provide the primary care. Too.
Okay. Why don't I give you my card? I'll bring it down this evening.
Should you ever lose this, if you can remember my last name, where you just sort of medical directors, the health aid program. Community health aid program.
Do you know that I'm in contact with a man in Australia that works with Aborigines that also has produced a kind of manual for community health aid?
It wouldn't be Paul Walker.
No.
I've worked with a number of people that have come over from Australia because they want to share ideas and get some ideas from us and so on.
He just wrote to me recently, and he had come to Nicaragua on one of those study
tours.
Maybe
from Darwin?
He's from in the Aborigine community. Uh-huh. But I have an extra copy of his little folder. Maybe I'll send it to you. It would be nice for you all to make the connection.
Like I say, we've had a few connections from here.
I can take this back, don't I?
Oh, I assume you know David Warner.
Well, David Warner is one of the founders of these two networks.
Uh-huh,
Yeah, that's where I'm going after right here. Uh-huh. David and I started the Central American Network, and then we started this one.